You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Today we're talking bikes. That's it. Bikes. If you don't like bikes, go away. We're talking to the bike snob, Eben Weiss, about his latest book. And also, Dave Trimble, the guy behind the Red Hook Criterium, talks about this astonishingly popular bike race and the crazy viral crash in Brooklyn of a couple weeks ago. That's coming up on the Free For All.
This is Free For All from the Wall Street Journal. Now, here's Jason Gay.
Hey, this is Jason Gay here on the Free For All. Jim Cherusmi is off hanging out with football players, which means that I get to talk about my pet topic in the Wall Street Journal, which is cycling and bikes and the world of bikes and the much maligned world of pro riding. And joining me today is a real authority on that world who made a name for himself originally anonymously as Bike Snob NYC. And his real name is Eben Weiss. And like myself, he's a New Yorker. And he has a new book, which is called, just as I reach over for it, The Ultimate Bicycle Owner's Manual, The Universal Guide to Bikes, Riding, and Everything for Beginner and Seasoned Cyclists. So in other words, if you've ridden a bike, if you know someone who's ridden a bike, if you're even thinking about riding a bike or you just saw a bike ride past you, this book is for you. And Eben, I'm looking here on Amazon. You are number one in bike repair. You're a number one bestseller in the bike repair category.
Oh, I know. I've been bragging about that on my blog.
Are you ahead of Bill Walton's Ultimate Guide?
At one point, I was number one in sports encyclopedias, which I don't know how that happened because it's not a sports encyclopedia by any stretch.
Well, I don't mean to diminish what you've built for yourself, which is a really cool franchise. I mean, are you surprised that you're doing this and there continues to be a demand for it? And, you know, that you're now, what is this, three or four books in for you?
I'm four books in. Yeah. I'm beyond surprised that I'm still here and writing books and writing a blog, but I am, and the cycling world can't shake me as much as they try.
Now, much in the same way, you know, Bruce Wayne put the costume away every once in a while and said never again, did you ever say to yourself, you know, it's time to put Bike Snob away?
Oh, yeah, all the time, every few days. That's it. The world doesn't deserve me. I'm done. I do that every few days. But then I start to think, like, I'm almost at 10 years, you know, so yeah. I figure you gotta plug away. It's exactly like cycling. It's like how you just want to, like, sit up and drift out the back, and then yeah. You're like, there's one more lap. I can bury myself. I can do it. So that's how it is.
The thing that you know, your continued career suggests to me, though, is that at the time you began Bike Snob NYC, and or rather at sort of that sort of tipping point where everyone kind of woke up to it and was talking about it, there was a lot of focus on cycling as fad, specifically track bikes as fad. We saw it endlessly yeah. in fashion and style and magazines and so forth. And yet this has gone long enough that it ain't no fad.
No. Well, it's not at all. I mean, cycling was never a fad. And I mean, it wasn't news to a lot of people that cycling was popular and more people were doing it and engaged in it and knowledgeable about it than maybe the mainstream media reflected.
Yeah.
And that whole track bike fad, I guess, kind of, it kicked it up a notch in one hand, but in the other hand, it kind of forced the mainstream media to acknowledge that bikes exist.
Yes.
And it gave them a handy little hook for talking about them.
Yes. And, you know, we continue to be arguing about many of the same things. I mean, to tell my personal story here, Eben, with, you know, cycling, I have two very small children, 3 and 1. I really took maybe 3.5, 4 years off the bike. You probably noticed it in all the park race results that my name wasn't in the top fives regularly.
You know, I'm always glued to the park race results. I have an app that feeds them to me.
I'm referring, of course, to the World Championships of Cycling that occurred in Central and Prospect Park on the weekends for about 8 months out of the year. But I really was off the bike for 3 years or so, and when I jumped back into those groups last summer for the first time intensely, it was the same damn conversation. It was people were talking about the same things, having the same arguments about the same people and the same topics that they were having.
Oh, please.
I love it.
Stand still. Time stands still. And you're doing, it's such a metaphor, you know, you're riding circles in the park in these races, around and around and around the park, talking about the same things. It's the same people. It's the same everything. It really is. That's what's great about it on one hand. It's time does stand still. It's like, you know, like Cheers or whatever. You walk in, it's the same guys.
Yeah.
Slice a bar.
I love that part of it. And we all need, you know, a side life like that. I think that it's a very healthy thing, unless you
absolutely
really go off the deep end. With the book, you know, the motivations for getting a book like this are plenty, but I'm curious, and I'm sure it, you know, occurred to you as you were doing this, is that there is a subset of cyclists out there now who has very, very high level, basically professional equipment. I mean, that's one of the funny quirks of the cycling world, is that you know, you can ride all the same stuff, if not better stuff, than the people who are riding the Tour de France or the Giro d'Italia, and yet. We find in many, many instances the people riding these equipment don't know the basics about how do they work. You know, even down
to good.
Yeah, and so, you know, this book is for many people, but I imagine there is a minimum. And how would you describe sort of the minimum entry point level one must have to be, you know, an adequate bicycle owner? You know, what are the...
It has to have two wheels and a functioning drivetrain and some means of stopping, some form of brake. And
well, no, you've
saddle,
described the obviously. Bike, and I'm going to agree with you. That is a bike. But but in terms of just, you know, rudimentary technical ability in terms of, you know, repairs and maintenance.
Yeah, no, I didn't mean to be flip with that answer. I think that, you know, it depends what we're talking about. If we're talking about what it takes to be maybe an amateur bike racer or somebody who's doing that stuff, that's a different entry point than someone who wants to learn the ins and outs of riding and just start riding. And I feel very strongly, and I say in the book, that if you're thinking about starting with bikes, don't worry about what you need. Don't worry about the equipment. Don't worry about anything. Just get your hands on a bike, bike. Adopt a bike. You know, so many people have bikes that are relegated to the basement or in a garage somewhere. You'd be surprised how easy it is to get your hands on one and ride it, and then figure out what you need and what kind of riding you like to do.
Absolutely. Is it a world of unspoken rules? We talk a lot about that in sports, like the sport of baseball. Yeah. You're supposed to do it this way, and if you don't, you're going to get a brushback pitch. I think of cycling as a world with the unspoken rules. And is this, you know, meant to at least sort of underline some of those for people who are joining the sport?
It underlines them to some degree. At the same time, I like to sort of undermine those rules, or at least make light of them, so people don't feel like they can't do it if they don't know the rules, or they're afraid of being ridiculed or something like that.
Yeah.
And the only way you get to know these rules is through experience, and you get to a point where you embrace some and you disregard others. So, but absolutely, I like to think that the book will sort of familiarize you with them, while at the same time, you know, treating them with the irreverence they deserve.
I'm ashamed to say that I'm a little hardcore about some of the rules. I cannot put the sunglasses underneath the helmet straps.
Yeah, underneath the helmet straps.
I can't do it.
It's counterintuitive to do that, you know. I mean, I think if you tell the average person that there's a rule that you're supposed to, when you're putting on your your eyewear, your optics, as they're called, which yes. normal people call sunglasses. Right? You put the arms over the helmet straps rather than under. The under would be the obvious thing to most people, but you put them over. Yeah, that's a tough one for people. But yeah, I adhere to that rule. I can't help it.
I want to confess something to you, which was last summer at the height of what I considered to be my, you know, miraculous comeback to the sport, I was riding up Union Street on my way to the park and felt just a little funny in the saddle and realized I had put my chamois on completely. I mean, I put my bike shorts on completely inside out. You know?
Oh my God, that's beautiful.
And I had,
I would have given anything to have been behind you and gotten that photo.
I know, perfect, right? And I had, on top of that, these were not like, you know, blacked out bike shorts. This was the one with like the red chamois. So I looked like I had a baboon's ass basically riding down the street.
I don't want to get too graphic, but if there was any detritus on your chamois, the world would have seen it. You know what I'm saying? Oh, that's beautiful. That's the classic dad move.
Yeah, absolutely.
You got a window to ride, and you probably just grabbed your clothes like, oh my God, I can get a ride in.
I like the being that dad biker. I like the way that you there's no dilly-dallying. You have to take advantage of the time that you get. I know you have children too. I also think that I just don't sweat equipment crap anymore. The idea of like going out and getting this.
No, you can't.
Yeah. Because every pair of shoes is like a semester of school.
Part of that's being a parent. Part of that's just getting older. Part of it's coming to terms with your abilities. And, yeah, at a certain point, you're like, how hung up on this stuff can you get?
Yeah.
And, I mean, I used to – I could. There was a time I could not have imagined going out on a road ride with a jersey – with a jersey that didn't match my shorts, like from the same uniform kit, as it's called, but the same like issue. Like I wouldn't wear, like, if they were a season apart and maybe the blues were slightly different, there was a time I would not have contemplated putting that outfit together. Now, please, I don't care what the shorts are. I don't care what the jersey is.
Yeah, no, exactly. You're on the bike.
My only requirement is I match the socks. I have not done non-matching socks, but I'm close. Like I'm at that point where I don't care.
Yeah.
Need that window. You get that window. You got to dive headfirst out that window to squeeze a ride in.
Exactly.
When you have kids.
Exactly. And yeah. I've gotten to the point now where I lay out the clothes the night before, which was something I never did before children.
You lay out the clothes what beforehand?
Yeah. Like I know, you know, and I know what I'm getting into. You know, I don't have time to like sort of sift through, you know, clothes and make decisions. I got to jump out. You know.
Well, yeah, if you have a morning ride, yeah. So wait, are you racing?
My wife hopefully doesn't listen to this podcast. So my wife was sort of like not into the idea of me throwing, and to be very clear to the listening public, Eben likes to say he's one of the worst bike racers in New York. I am the worst bike racer in New York. I finished the caboose of the caboose. And yet I loved it, and it made me feel cool in a way that nothing ever did in my uncool life. And I jumped into a couple of park races last year without telling my wife when she was away with the children. And, you know, everyone sort of makes that calculation.
that was what you did.
Yeah.
Of all the things you could have done.
Isn't that really funny? Like, that's the thing. Exactly. That's it's funny. Like, you know, I'm not like having a house party. I'm not carousing. I'm not philandering. I'm waking up at 5:15 in the morning.
You're gonna wait to do a 6 a.m. park.
Oh, philandering would actually be a lot easier, you know, and less stressful. I want to talk to you.
That's why cyclists, like if you want to make the safe bet as far as loyalty, like no bike racer could ever be an adulterer. It's not, they don't have the energy. They don't have the time.
No.
And if they have an opportunity to do anything, it's a ride.
They don't want to go upstairs. You know, they don't want to do any of that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, they're terrible mates. I mean, we don't like to do it. We don't want to go out at night. We're tired, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
We have to get up early the next day. We want to spend all day riding. We don't want to go to the Brooklyn Flea or whatever it is, but at least we're loyal.
I want to ask you about another part of your life as a cycling writer. Is, you know, you have been, you know, a real advocate for cyclist safety, and you have a piece that ran in the Washington Post. We won't hold it against you a couple weeks ago. And the headline of it was, "Don't make bicyclists more visible, make drivers stop hitting them." And, you know, that's mm-hmm. funny, but it also speaks to a truism, which is that there is a lot of belief in the infrastructure, transportation infrastructure community of cyclists, the burden being upon cyclists to be safe. And you're sort of saying the opposite.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we as a culture, society, whatever you want to call it, we just bend over backwards and contort ourselves inside and out to defend any motorist behavior.
Yeah.
And that's something.
Everything's an accident.
As I'm saying, everything's an accident, and that's a big thing in the advocacy community. Yeah. They're trying to get the word accident out of news reports because you'll read about some horrible, fatal collision, and before, you know, they'll say the police are still investigating the accident. If they're still investigating, how do you know it was an accident?
Right.
Road rage doesn't happen. You know, people don't drive recklessly.
Right.
What is the natural outcome of reckless driving anyway?
Right.
It's not, oops, I hit somebody. What do you think is going to happen?
Yeah.
So it's really like once you probe into this stuff, you see how deeply ingrained it is to absolve drivers of everything.
Yeah.
And so everything gets shifted on to the more vulnerable road users, and not just cyclists, pedestrians too.
Sure.
You know, I go into the story about, you know, jaywalking is a term that the auto industry came up with in the last century to turn pedestrians into these hapless fools to make it sound like they were the engineers of their own demise.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole thing's so ingrained. And I think people are starting to realize we have to break that. And that's what the story's about. You know, putting a helmet on a cyclist doesn't solve these problems.
I'm writing about something for later on this week in the journal, and you might hate me for it, but talking about the idea of what's the burden upon cyclists. And, you know, I certainly don't think it's incumbent upon cyclists to, like, you know, relinquish the roadways or you know, stop advocating for bicycle lanes and so on. But, you know, I think it's fairly clear that there's a public relations issue for the cycling community. And in particular, the thing that drives me nuts is how it's just, you know, brushed as, like, you know, spandex warriors and, like, doesn't account for the vast, vast majority of cycling traffic being commuters and people working and so on and so forth. But do you know, we all know a few folks, and I've been one of them, frankly, you know, who've hawked a few loogies and given a few fingers in a lifetime. And, you know, does that need to curtail a little bit in terms of just the general courtesies of the road? Because, you know, we both remember when riding in this city was a total free-for-all, in some ways safer, but was a real total free-for-all, and that behavior is hardwired, I think, for a lot of people. Should we lighten up a little?
I think that there is a certain, obviously everybody should be accountable for their behavior, and a cyclist who's behaving recklessly can be dangerous, and all of that stuff, and they need to be accountable for that, and people need to be mindful. At the same time, the idea that cyclists are more reckless than other road users is, I don't buy that at all. And I don't buy, and certainly the consequences of that behavior are a lot different than the consequences of being an irresponsible driver. So that's important to say. And I think that While it's true that there's some bad riding out there, and obviously people need to ride well, it needs to be kept in perspective. And it's also as you say, there was a time when a lot of this bike infrastructure wasn't there, I shouldn't say kill or be killed, but it was
effectively.
You know, it was. You weren't really going to kill anybody.
Yeah.
It was ride like crazy or be killed.
Yeah.
So we don't have a long ingrained sort of we haven't had the opportunity to ride any differently, really.
Yeah.
And a lot of people who are cycling now, they haven't spent a lifetime cycling.
Yeah.
They haven't grown up with it.
Yeah.
A lot of people haven't grown up on bikes. Yeah. So yeah, they're a little bit clueless because we don't have the tradition.
Yeah.
I think that's going to change as more and more people are riding.
Yeah.
And there's more and more infrastructure. I do think one thing I really believe strongly is that kids in school should learn cycling.
Yeah.
They should learn fundamentals.
Yeah.
If you grow up on a bike, you would handle your bike a lot better. And yeah. There are some people who are new, who are exuberant, who yeah. haven't been riding that long, and maybe yeah. they're not. They don't quite have it together. But
why is it that
that's going to change?
Why is it that you hear people? We've all been in conversations somewhere where somebody can remember very vividly the cyclist who rode by them when they were walking down the street and told them to get the F off the road. And all of us at the same time have a lifetime of erratic driver behavior, sometimes very hairy experience. And that doesn't get the same kind of visceral reaction.
You have to take a step back. It's very hard to do to kind of shake yourself out of this. How heavily the automotive industrial complex or whatever you want to call it weighs on your life.
Yeah.
Every sign you see, every line on the road, all of this stuff is designed for cars
yeah.
and drivers.
Yeah.
And there are so many cars around you. And you get to a point where you don't notice anymore. It's noise,
right.
But once you start to kind of realize that and you pay attention, you see how egregious the behavior it is. But the reason it's easy to kind of not do that and take it for granted and then get annoyed when the cyclist buzzes you is because there's fewer of them.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's true. And we have helmets.
It's a very heavy, it's like, it's like the movie They Live. With Roddy Piper, you got to put on the glasses,
What's the? Oh yeah, it's the bubblegum line, right? It's the bubblegum line, right? Or I ran out of gum.
Yeah, we got to. If I'm all out of bubble, I can't remember.
I'm all out of
bubblegum. I came
bubble
here gum. To kick ass and chew bubblegum, and I'm all out of bubblegum. Yeah. It's time we spit out the bubblegum and put on the sunglasses and gotten all this sorted out. That's what I think.
I love it. Evan Weiss is the author of The Ultimate Bicycle Owner's Manual, The Universal Guide to Bikes, Riding, and Everything for Beginner and Seasoned Cyclists. And, again, you don't have to be a spandex warrior to enjoy a book like this. You might know somebody who's in cycling. You might be somebody on the periphery of the sport who's just getting excited about riding a bike or perhaps even buying a bike. It's for everyone. Evan, thanks for being with me. I know you're going to join me for the next segment coming up. Dave Trimble of the Red Hook Criterium will be joining us here on the Free For All. Coming right back.
Hi, I'm Paul Vigna. If you do not subscribe to the Money Beat podcast, you are going to feel worse than a short seller on the day of a big rally. Go to iTunes and WSJ.com/podcasts. You want to sign up for this one.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously. Now, back to the show.
Hey, we're back here on the free-for-all. This is the all-bikes free-for-all because Cheruzmi is away and I'm getting to do what I want to do. And joining me right now is a real leader in the American bike race, or rather I should say the international bike race world, David Trimble from Brooklyn, New York, who is the guy behind the Red Hook Criterium, a bike race which began in the neighborhood of Red Hook, Brooklyn, but has since expanded across the ocean. And where else do you do it now, David?
Hi, Jason. Thanks for having me. Yeah, we do the race now in Brooklyn, London, Barcelona, and Milan.
Amazing, amazing. And you are in your eighth or ninth year of doing this. Ninth year?
Ninth year, yeah. Ninth year in Brooklyn, and we're getting into our seventh year in Europe. So,
now, the first question I have for you is that, cycling, in my exposure to it as an amateur hack racer, races come and races go. Promoters come and promoters go. It's not a sport where promoters, make a tremendous living, if a living at all, and it's pretty volatile out there for people who like to race their bikes. And you have found something, some kind of formula where you continue to grow. And there's a real passion for these events. You're not doing them all the time, which might be one of the reasons why you're able to sort of put up such great events. But why do you think this is working? Because, you know, you've done this through a recession. You've done this now through multiple changes in the industry. Why do you think you've continued to prosper?
Yeah, I think it's pretty simple. You know, we make a race that's extremely spectator friendly, and we do it in major cities around the world, you know, New York, London, and Barcelona and Milan. So there's, you know, an amazing community of people who are able to come out to the race. And you called it a formula, but, you know, my actual inspiration is from Formula One. So
oh,
I'm
yeah.
trying to make the Formula One of bike racing. And, you know, once you make something that's really accessible and exciting for spectators, there's tons of room for growth. You know, sponsors, you know, there's not a lot of other good races, you know, spectator-friendly races out there
yeah.
that are really confined in this urban environment. So once you create something that catches on, there's lots of interest for it to keep growing.
And, you know, roughly give a sense for how this has grown, you know, in terms of, you know, the worldwide interest, the participants, the crowds, you know, how big has it gotten?
Yeah, you know, when I started it, it was nothing. It was like 15 people at the first race in 2008.
Yeah.
You know, now the last race in Brooklyn, we had, you know, 15,000 spectators, riders from over 40 different countries. So it's, you know, in a span of just 9 years, it's gone from nothing to what it is now. And so every year it seems like it doubles in size from the year before.
And you've had some pretty marquee sponsors, if you want to name a few of them.
Yeah, we've had now entering our fourth year with Rockstar Games as a presenting
yeah.
sponsor.
Yeah.
You know, they really love cycling and they like to see it grow.
Yeah.
And we've also aligned with some of the best brands in cycling, such as Specialized and Castelli and Strava and Giro. So
we've really
tapped into some great sponsors.
And you have beer.
Beer, yeah.
That's
it took
amazing.
Us a while to get the beer sales going at the Brooklyn Cruise Terminal, but this year we went through 60 kegs. So
oh, my goodness.
A lot of beer drinking at the race.
Evan, did you have any one? Are you responsible for one or two of those kegs?
I wasn't at the race this year. I have been in the past.
Yeah. Now
I helped at home.
Now, how do you go to the, I mean, who supervises the Brooklyn Cruise Terminal? Is this the city of New York or is this a Port Authority? Who runs this joint?
The Port Authority owns it. Then it's managed by the New York City Economic Development Corporation. And they also have a private operator. So it's you got to go through several different channels.
And it's very hard, you know, for people who are listening to this, it's very hard to get a closed course bike race nowadays. You know, in the old days, people used to close down, you know, downtown New York or Union Square, and they'd have criteriums and so on. That stuff doesn't really happen anymore. No one wants to take on that kind of risk and liability. How do you get these folks to agree to a bike race?
Well, yeah, luckily, you know, we got in there at the right time. We had some good connections, and then we just, you know, the race was pretty small when we first started there.
Yeah.
And as the race grew, we also really improved our infrastructure and our planning and our security and safety measures. So they were able to see that, you know, as the race grew, we
yeah.
were going to be able to control it. But yeah, it's a lot of bureaucracy and a lot of work.
Yeah, so that's probably accounting for a lot of your off-season work is meetings and conference calls.
Oh, yeah, months and months of meetings.
And how do you navigate it when you're overseas, or do you have help over there from people who can help you over there?
Yeah, so we have a local producer in each city who helps us navigate the bureaucracy, and it's totally different in every city, and it's really a challenge, but, you know, it's what it takes.
But you are not Mr. Hands-off, you know, promoter guy. One of the things I get a kick out of is seeing you riding around on your bike on the course, you know, telling people when things are coming up. You know, you're hands-on still. You've not gone complete Hollywood on this.
No, definitely not. It's still definitely a labor of love, and I'm kind of involved in every aspect of the organization. You know, I'll go to Europe for 6 months starting in June to run the races there. So yeah, it's definitely a labor of love. And you know, I love being the race official, so I get to make the final calls on the rules. I don't think I'll ever, you know, no matter what happens, how big it gets, I'll never be hands off.
Now, we should mention that one of the ingredients of the Red Hook Criterium, which makes it much different than your average bike race, is that you're racing track bikes on the road. And track bikes are single-speed bikes, which do not have brakes. You probably see them in Olympic sports and the velodrome. And it's a little unusual to see them race on a closed road course like this. But this sort of adds to the excitement of it. And, of course, we've seen in the last decade and a half just the incredible explosion of interest in single speed riding. Did you go back and forth when you were creating Whistles, or did you always think that this was going to be a single speed race?
Yeah, I always intended to use the track bikes. At the time when I founded the race, I was racing traditional USA Cycling road races, and I was racing Alley Cats, and right. So I wanted to combine the two disciplines, and I knew how skilled riders could be on a track bike.
Yeah.
And, the track bike makes the race a lot more spectator friendly because it requires more technical skill. So you end up with a race that's typically more strung out, where the riders are more in a single file line, and the riders who are aggressive at the front are the riders who win. Whereas a traditional road race, usually the rider who's hidden inside the peloton saving the most amount of energy wins the race.
That's really interesting, because I've thought to myself, when you see a course like that, you're like, oh, that'd be really cool to have a regular road bike race on it. But you're absolutely right that it would probably be kind of a bunch sprint, kind of a boring race to watch, probably.
Yeah, whoever is sheltered from the wind up until the very last moment wins the race. Red Hook Crits, the guys who are going on the attack win the race. So it's easier for someone who doesn't know a lot about bike racing to understand.
Yeah. Now, for people who, have competed in this, is your average person who performs well at this, are they strictly a track rider, or are they people who have sort of capacity in both road and track riding?
I mean, usually the guys who win have experience in a lot of different cycling disciplines. We never have someone who's just coming from one discipline who does well, because it's such a different format. If you're good on a road bike and a mountain bike and on the track, you usually tend to come to Red Hook and it's like no problem for you.
Yeah, Evan, you ever tempted to try the Red Hook Crit?
Well, in the early days, I thought about it for maybe 5 seconds, but I came to my senses. I probably would not have fared very well out there, but I'm a fan of the race. I appreciate what David's done with it, and I think that the size of the crowd bears that out. I mean, he's done a great job with it, and it's good to see people excited about a race.
I mean, I had the same. Well, maybe I don't know if the same, but I think a rather typical reaction to it, which is that the first time I heard about it, I was like, "What is this?" And then I went, and I was like, "This is like everything that I wish a bike race that I was in was like." It's like crowds. There are girls here. There's like an amazing women's race. There are sponsors. It's at night. All this stuff. The accoutrements that you feel amazing. And it's not, we should point out that you have multiple races during this thing. It's not strictly for, pro level track riders. Is that right?
Yeah. I think one of the kind of big appeals of the race is that like anybody can try it.
Yeah.
Literally you can sign up and attempt to qualify. So we had qualifying sessions all day and, we have, a range of riders who it's their first race up until world-class pros. So it's kind of it really is a race for everyone, and that gets people excited. They get to measure themselves, against the best.
So this year in the men's race, there was a viral moment, which was there was and I don't mean to be glib about it or it was funny about it, because I'm sure in the moment it was terribly serious. Which was there was a motorbike which I don't know if it stalled or malfunctioned somehow and stalled in the middle of the road and caused a pileup. There looked to me at least like a dozen bikes were upended in a very spectacular crash, which, like Eben, I was sort of following this virally. It just went everywhere. I mean, the video of this crash. First of all, can you give the status of the riders who were involved in the pileup? How are people doing?
Yeah, luckily we're very fortunate where there's no major injuries at all in the crash.
Good.
Just everything very minor. Three riders were transported to the hospital that night, and they were all treated and released, and they're all pretty much back on a bike already.
That's
again.
Good. That's good. Now, I'm thinking of you in this moment. Had I been running a race like this and something like that happened, I would have curled up into a fetal ball and no one would have been able to find me. How do you sort of keep your composure and, like, get the race restarted and do all the stuff you're supposed to be doing?
Yeah, it was definitely a lot of confusion, but luckily I have a really good team helping me run the race. So we have the course marshals, we have the circuit manager and the medical team and the event control, and everyone, it took us some time to get a kind of full stock of the situation and figure out what had happened and what we needed to do to get the race restarted. But everyone on the team, played their part perfectly. And, the second we were able to get all the ambulances back in place and get organized to go again, we were able to. But yeah, it was very stressful in the moment.
And just to clarify, was it a stall from the moto? Is that what had happened?
Yeah, that's what happened. It was our, the only, we've used that moto driver, every year at the Red Hook Crit since 2012. And it was really just a kind of lapse in concentration and the moto stalled right as the race was starting.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, of course, you're probably not aware of it at the time because you're running around trying to, ensure people's safety and get the race restarted. But, this thing starts to go viral and it gets to the point where I was at home on Sunday and I'm watching the ABC World News and it's one of the lead stories on the ABC News. And I'm like, what the heck? And then it becomes sort of both this viral video, but then this sort of, we know how things work on Twitter and social media, this like lightning rod for, a debate about the race and, whether or not it's unsafe and so on. And Eben, I know you have some thoughts about this because, the truth of it is you look at this event, this crash, this could have happened in any bike race. We all ride in races where they've had motos and wacky things happen. I remember garbage trucks wandering into Prospect Park all the time. It's sort of one of those there but for the grace of God go I kind of things. Was there anything in particular about it, Eben, that made you think, oh, well, this gives me pause about this crit?
No, it was quite the opposite. I had words with a certain senior editor at a certain cycling sports publication who came online after that video started making the rounds saying these guys are dumb and idiots, I believe are direct quotes for racing bricks.
Yeah.
I'm not a fan of, people ripping around the city on track bikes who can't handle their track bikes, but on a closed course like that, everyone's riding the same equipment. That's what the race is. There's no problem with that.
Right.
And
right.
These kinds of pileups happen in crits all the time.
Right.
And when they happen, when you're, as Jason, as a racer, when you, when someone goes down up ahead, you don't know what's happening and everyone just piles up.
Of course not. Yeah.
So, I thought it was very disingenuous of a sporting publication in particular to insult riders even before you know how they're doing, in a crash that could happen in any type of race.
And Dave, how are you feeling in the sort of aftermath of this? Of course, you're probably exhausted just from putting it on, but are you kind of like, oh my God, I can't believe I have to deal with this?
Yeah, it was the media attention was definitely unfortunate. It's understandable because it was such a visible moment.
Yeah.
But really overshadowed what was an amazing race. Before the crash and after the crash, we had really amazing performances, and we had much fewer crashes than we've ever had before. And the race, the racetrack was much more organized and safer than we've ever had it before. So it really kind of overshadowed what I thought the big story was how amazing the racing was. And if any of the critics had actually taken the time to watch, footage of the actual race, they would have realized that, the event was safe and very well organized, and it was just that one crash kind of overshadowed it all.
Yeah, I want to underline, as someone who has gone to a recent Red Hook Criterium, that it is about as far from a demolition derby atmosphere as you can imagine. It's as, hyper-organized as you'll find in racing in America right now. Any part of you, Dave, want to sort of throw in the towel, or are you motivated as ever to come back for 2017 with Red Hook Crit?
I'm more motivated than ever. There's a lot of critics, but there's also tons of people came out to support the race.
Yeah.
Talked about how passionate they were for it. And, we had the professional riders who were in the field wrote reports about how they felt it was safer than any of the other races they do throughout the season. So, I saw a lot of support as well as, a lot of negativity. But
Well, that's life, right? That's what we all deal with, right? It's a sad state of affairs, but you're doing good work out there, Dave. Keep your head up.
All right. Yeah, we're all right. We're ready for London next.
All right. Well, thanks very much for coming on and talking about the Red Hook Criterion and clearing the air on, you know, the viral mania, Dave Trimble. And Eben Weiss, good luck with the book. Everyone should buy it.
Thank you.
Everybody should buy it. Dave, you should buy several.
I definitely will.
Maybe those guys, if they read my book, would know how to stop their butts. No,
yeah.
Thanks for joining us here on the Free For All. As always, you can find us in wonderful podcast stores like iTunes. And thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously.